time I'm giving such a phone talk, so if I just forget to say go to next slide, then I have my friends here who will tell me. So please wait. So if there is some confusion, please wait for some time. So now I am on the first slide. I hope everyone is on the first slide. The title of the talk is Big Bang and Loop Quantum Cosmology. And this is based on the work which I have been doing with Abhay and Tomasz Pawlowski. Just 1 second. Let's go to the next slide. Okay. So, as we all know, the standard model of cosmology provides an excellent agreement with observational data, particularly when the curvature is very low. So if you ask any cosmologist, he'll tell you that we are presently in the stage of precision cosmology. So what we mean by precision cosmology is that in contrary to the days which were in 1950s or 1960s, where you can live with two paradigms, for example, the hot Big Bang model or the steady state model, and can peacefully coexist without any observational details. Now, the observations are so good that even small bumps in the inflationary potential can be severely restricted. For example, by cosmic microwave background, power spectrum, or the if you are looking at the quintessence models and supernova observations. So though we have a very nice working model in standard cosmology, with a working model I mean that you start with the hot Big Bang, and then you add a phase of inflation to explain why the universe accelerated in the very early universe. You add dark energy to explain why the universe is accelerating now. And to make the content, you put in dark matter. And depending on your choices of or your theoretical prejudices, you can add many other things like phantoms or tachyons and so on. So it's the working model is made up of various components, and it successfully tries to answer various observations which are going on and which will go on in future. There are various important questions which remain unanswered. And any cosmologist will tell you that these are the kind of questions which quantum gravity people should try to answer, and that is what we are trying to do in this talk. So what are those kind of questions which have remained unanswered? Perhaps the most important question is that if you start with the backward evolution of our universe, then we get into the Big Bang singularity. And the Big Bang singularity is inevitable, and it's a result of powerful singularity theorems in general relativity. What it tells us is that general relativity is inadequate to provide correct physics at high curvature scale. That puts into doubt various models for the universe which constitute the working model of cosmology. Essentially, whenever there is an occurrence of singularity in a theory, it tells us about the limit of the validity of the theory has been reached, and we should look for a more fundamental theory than, in this case, the general relativity. So that is what is the big problem, and this has always been overlooked by doing, for example, phenomenology in classical cosmology, but this is a deep problem, and people have been trying to understand this issue further. Apart from the singularity problem in classical cosmology, there are various models which constitute this working model, which assume some things like how the perturbations are generated in the very early universe. For example, if you take the case of inflation, and if we are looking at the large scale inflation, then the inflation doesn't occur very far below the Planck scale. And this assumption can be questioned, that why do we assume that when the inflation starts, let's say at 10 to the power 16 or 10 to the power 17 GeV, we had a continuum space-time on which the perturbations could have been generated. So this is an important question. And apart from these kind of questions, which remain unaddressed or not so much addressed in the cosmological framework, there are questions like of dark energy. Now, some people believe that the issue of dark energy is intricately related to our understanding of the quantum nature of space-time. Well, it may or it may not happen. What I wanted to say was that there is a list of questions of which some of them can only be addressed by quantum gravity, and some of them may be partially addressed by quantum gravity, and general relativity may be sufficient to answer questions like dark energy itself. So the idea is that we definitely need inputs from a more fundamental theory, and in this case, quantum gravity.
And this provides us an excellent opportunity, the people for people who are also doing quantum gravity, because now we can start looking for the applications of our theory in cosmological models. And since we are in the age of precision cosmology, the days are not far in which we can start constraining the parameters of quantum gravity using astronomical observations. So this is a good opportunity for us, and this is what is the aim of this talk, that what does quantum gravity tell us about the physics near the Big Bang? And this is based on work with Jan Stricker and Tomasz Pawlowski. So now I'll go to the next slide. So to probe the question, what is the physics near the Big Bang, we can readdress that question into a set of questions. So perhaps the most important question most important sub-question of this question is that does the theory provide a non-singular evolution through the Big Bang? So we may come up with a model of very early universe based on fundamental theory like string theory or loop quantum gravity, but this is the most important question which any quantum cosmological model or any cosmological model based on a fundamental theory should address, that whether there is a non-singular evolution which goes through the Big Bang, or what is the Big Bang? Is Big Bang replaced by something else? But can we evolve from our expanding phase to some other phase? The next question which is related to this is, what is on the other side of Big Bang, or essentially what is the Big Bang? Is it a quantum form or is it a classical space-time? So if you look into literature, we find examples where where people have proposed models in which the universe on the other side is a quantum form. But more popular ideas are that the universe on the other side is again a classical space-time. For example, the pre-Big Bang scenario in string cosmology or ecbiotic or cyclic models. So this is another question which is related to the first. So once we have a non-singular evolution and once we know what is on the other side of Big Bang, then we have to also ask the question, what is the scale at which our classical space-time in which we live ceases to be classical? The next question is, does the space-time continuum which we see around us exist at all scales? Does it exist especially when the primordial fluctuations were generated in the very early universe? So answer to this question is very important if we want to have any theory which can, for example, explain cosmic microwave background. The next question is related to what are the effective equations. So we all know that the Friedman equation, which says that the square of the Hubble is A dot over A, where A is a scale factor, is proportional to the energy density. So what is the scale at which this Friedman equation is modified, and how is it modified? So this is another question which we have to ask. And I think the most important question from this set, once we have the non-singular evolution, once we know what is on the other side of the Big Bang, how is the effective equations modified, we have to ask, does the theory make any testable predictions, and does it conform with observations? So we can have a model which answers all the previous questions, but if it doesn't make any testable predictions, it will get very limited success. So if you look into literature, there are various models which try to answer the last four set of questions, assuming that the first will be achieved successfully, any fundamental theory. So our approach here is really from top down. So we will start with asking the first question and then move on to the higher level of questions, moving towards the testable predictions. This is the last question is the one which I will not touch in my talk much today. Essentially, if you see, this is a very complex set of questions, and it's very difficult to answer all these questions without making detailed analytical, phenomenological, or numerical investigations. Now I'll move to the next slide. So there have been various innovative ideas which have tried to answer these questions, and I'll not list all of them, but at least some of them, which will, because their physical ramifications or the limitations of their physical ideas will become clear when we start doing our model. So perhaps the first idea which gained most of the attention was in the 90s based on string cosmology. It's called pre-Big Bang scenario. It was based on the scale factor duality of string dilaton action. The idea was that Big Bang is not the beginning. It's just a point in the evolution of the universe which constitutes a pre-Big Bang branch. Pre-Big Bang branch has Hubble positive, and H dot, which is the rate of change of Hubble rate, also positive. So the pre-Big Bang branch is superinflating, and it is joined to the post-Big Bang branch at near the Big Bang. The theory was developed in the perturbative string theory, and the problem was that, as you see in the figure, you have a pre-Big Bang branch, which is superinflating, and the post-Big Bang branch, which is decelerating. The problem was that the transition between the two branches required inputs from non-perturbative string theory, as at least it was hoped, and the transition was never achieved successfully. So the major problem was that though the pre-Big Bang model envisioned that there is a pre-Big Bang phase of the universe, which is classical, there was no evolution between the pre-Big Bang and the post-Big Bang phase. So the aim of the model was to explain the generation of perturbations in the pre-Big Bang branch and to link them with the observations in the post-Big Bang branch. But unless we have a non-singular evolution from the pre-Big Bang phase to the post-Big Bang phase, we cannot achieve the same, because we cannot tell how do the perturbations propagate through the Big Bang. So this was a major problem. So I should add here that it is possible, but at the expense of violating all positive energy conditions, to achieve a non-singular evolution in special cases. But you have to violate the null energy condition to do that. So similar problems existed with ekperiodic and cyclic models. So these models, ekperiodic and cyclic models, are based on the dynamics of the brains, in which it is envisioned that our universe is on one brain, and the Big Bang corresponds to the collision of the two brains. And as in the pre-Big Bang model, the transition from the pre-Big Bang phase in the cyclic model to the post-Big Bang phase on the brain is not non-singular. Again, in special cases, one can give away the positive energy conditions, and then one may achieve such a non-singular bounce, but it's very special, it's not generic. So with these two innovative ideas, which try to give a picture that our expanding phase of the universe was preceded by another phase of the universe, which was classical, and whatever we see in the cosmic microwave background today had the seeds of generations in the pre-Big Bang phase. The ideas had limited success just because we don't know how to evolve from the pre-Big Bang phase to the post-Big Bang phase, because we don't know the non-perturbative quantum gravitational effects, which are dominant in that regime. So now I'll go to the next slide. So as with the models which propose, or which try to propose what's going on on the other side of the Big Bang, there were models which also proposed the modifications to high energies. So the idea in these models was that the classical general relativity is envisioned as a low energy effective theory. It should be modified at high energies. And there are various popular ideas which used to obtain these modifications. These modifications may arise due to higher order terms in the gravity action. They may arise due to large extra dimensions. It just depends on whatever extra things we want to do. So an example is that of a Randall-Sundar model, which was very popular recently, in which our universe is envisioned on a brain in a five-dimensional anti-de-Sitter bulk. And one can obtain an effective Friedman equation. One can obtain a Friedman equation on the brain by using the junction conditions, and that is equal to h squared equal to kappa by 3 rho. Kappa is 8 pi g. Rho is the energy density. And then in the parenthesis, 1 plus rho by 2 sigma. And sigma is the brain tension. So when we reach, the idea was that when we reach the scales of the energy density, when it is off the order of the brain tension, then the h squared equation becomes rho squared equation. But as in the standard cosmology, we know that rho goes as a to the power minus n, depending on what is the matter content. So if we have a massless scalar field, n is equal to 6. So as a goes to 0, or as we approach Big Bang, both parameter and rho, they diverge. So we get a singular evolution, and the problems related to Big Bang in standard cosmology remain as they are in these models. So even extensions have been studied of the Randall-Sundar models. For example, one can ad hoc assume an existence of two time-like dimensions in the bulk, and these are unnatural conditions which have shown that they can give a bounce, but they don't descend from any fundamental theory. Now I'll go to the next slide. So if you see that there have been there has been a limited success in understanding how is the Friedman equation modified at high energies, and also what is on the other side of the Big Bang, or what is the Big Bang. So there have been paradigms, but which lacked essentially the proof that one can go from one branch to the other branch. And if you look at them in detail, we understand that their hope was that by including higher order perturbative corrections, assuming a continuum space-time, one might be able to capture the details of singularity resolution. And we have seen that this leads to a limited success. So I think the basic problem with, or basic limitation why of these models was the assumption that one can take the space-time continuum at all scales. So, for example, loop quantum gravity tells us that about the discrete structure of space-time, and this assumption completely ad hoc, that one can assume the existence of space-time continuum even at the scales near the Big Bang. Furthermore, in all these approaches, what has been missing so far is a complete analysis of non-perturbative quantum gravitational effects. And this is what we want to include. This is what we should look for to complete a quantum cosmological model. So these models, which have not considered the quantum nature of the dynamical space-time, that is, and I feel that is the reason why they miss the resolution of singularity in full generality. So this, in fact, shifts the onus to us who are doing a non-perturbative quantum gravity, that whether a model in non-perturbative quantum gravity can resolve the Big Bang singularity or not. So I'll go to the next slide now. Yes, slide number 7. So one of the leading approaches is loop quantum gravity, which is background independent and non-perturbative quantum gravity. And our strategy is to construct a quantum cosmological model based on loop quantum gravity. And that is what is known as loop quantum cosmology. So I should first state here the caveat very, very carefully that I'm not trying to construct any cosmological model in full theory. I'm just trying to construct a cosmological model in symmetry reduced theory. So I'm working completely in a homogeneous anisotropic setting. Loop quantum cosmology has also been extended for anisotropies, and the work has also been started for inhomogeneities, but I will only address the issues in the homogeneous anisotropic setting. And in particular, I'll work completely with a flat k equal to zero cosmological model. Also, we don't know what is the exact relationship of loop quantum cosmology with respect to loop quantum gravity. We don't know whether it descends from, in what way it descends from loop quantum gravity. So the relationship with the full theory is unclear. What do we want to achieve with such a study? Essentially, we have various hopes. The hope is that by doing loop quantum cosmology, or by looking at these quantum cosmological models, we get glimpses of how singularity resolution occurs in full theory and what is the physics of the very early universe. Loop quantum cosmology can also be an ideal testing ground for learning how to build models, how to do phenomenological applications, and making testable predictions, and which can be useful. So the idea is we want to lay out a procedure which can be used even in the full theory. And we also hope that by looking at these symmetry-reduced models, we may be able to get some valuable insights into the program in loop quantum gravity and other non-perturbative approaches. So I'll give an example of this towards the end of my talk. In the case where loop quantum cosmology can help us understand the issue of ambiguities. I'll now go to the next slide, slide number 8. The loop quantum cosmology is a homogeneous anisotropic setting, and for the flat k equal to 0 model, the spatial manifold has a topology RQ, and it is endowed with the action of Euclidean group. And due to this, one can fix a fiducial metric, and one can introduce a fiducial triad, which I call EAI with an O, and a co-triad, omega IA with an O. The symmetries of the FW space-time, essentially what we do is we fix the gauge and diffeomorphism of some invariance, and we can cast the connection A and the triad E in very simple forms. So one can write this equation, what I have, A of IA equal to C with the co-triad, and the triad E of AI expressed completely in terms of component P times the determinant and the triad and the fiducial triad. So the information about the connection and the triad is completely encoded in the components C and P. And these are our basic variables which satisfy Poisson Beckett relationship C, P equal to 8 pi g gamma by 3. So how are these related to scale factor? That's easy to understand. That essentially, first we note that the triad can have two possible orientations, and it is related as mod p equal to a square, where a is a scale factor. And on the space of physical solutions of general relativity, c is related to the rate of change of the scale factor. So c is equal to gamma a dot. Gamma is the emergency parameter. As in loop quantum gravity, our elementary variables are holonomies over some curve of length mu. So these are given by hk mu equal to cosine of mu c by 2, density matrix plus 2 sine mu c by 2, tau of k, where tau of k is related to polyspin matrices, as tau is minus I polyspin matrix by 2. And mu here is arbitrary. It can go from minus infinity to infinity. The elements of this, algebra formed by holonomies are of the form exponential I mu c by 2, and this is an algebra of almost periodic functions. So we can find out the representation of this algebra and also the Hilbert space which underlies this representation. It's what is H kinematical equal to L2 R B d mu b, where R b is the Bohr compactification of the real line and d mu b is the hard measure on it. So these elements, which were of the form exponential I mu c by 2, they form an orthonormal basis in this Hilbert space, and they satisfy this relationship of the product between n mu and n mu prime, which is equal to the Kronecker delta mu mu prime. So as we see, the Hilbert space at the kinematical level from the Willer-DeWitt theory. So I'll go to the next slide now. Once we have the H kinematical and we have the elementary variables, we can look for the Hamiltonian constraint. So the Hamiltonian constraint is the C grab, which is equal to minus gamma to the power minus 2. The integration is over V, which I'll explain now in a minute. And it's d cube x, n is the lattice, epsilon ijk, the field strength FIAB, and the product of the triads divided by the determinant of E. So the integration is over the volume of the fiducial cell, which we have fixed because our manifold is non-compact. And the strategy is to express this classical gravitational constraint in terms of the elementary variables and their Poisson brackets. We can first look at the term containing the triads. As we see, it has an inverse power of the determinant of the triad. And as in the loop quantum gravity, we use the procedure laid out by Feynman to express this term EAJ EBK into a Poisson bracket of the holonomies and the positive power of triad. The positive power, the V is the volume function on the phase space, and it is equal to mod P to the power 3 by 2. The important thing is that in this identity, mu bar can be a function of P. And since so one can check that even if mu bar is a function of P, these identities will not change. The next step is to write the field strength tensor. And since we don't have an operator for it, we write it as a limit of a holonomy around the loop. So one can take a square loop. So we write it as a limit of holonomy around the square loop divided by the area of the loop. And then we can let the limit of this area going to zero. So combining this, one can get in the classical theory itself, one can write down the constraint, which is the equation on the top, completely in terms of the holonomies and the volumes. And if you take the area of this loop at the classical level going to zero, then you get back the expression what you had earlier in terms of the gravitational constraint. But when you quantize, this limit doesn't exist. And essentially, it's a reminder to us that there is no operator corresponding to FIAB in the quantum theory. So this procedure of taking the limit of the loop shrinking to some finite minimum value is well defined in the full theory in loop quantum gravity on diffeomorphism invariant states. But in loop quantum cosmology, we do not have diffeomorphism invariance, and essentially we need a new strategy in how to accomplish it. And this is what is some new input which comes at this stage, that how to express FIABs as an operator, FIABs as a, the FIABs in the quantum theory. So the idea was given in by Ashteker, Boyewald, and Lewandowski in 2003, that is to exploit the area gap in loop quantum gravity and to set the minimum area of the loop or, over which we are evaluating the holonomies to the area gap in the of the minimum eigenvalue of the area operator in loop quantum gravity. So this is what is that delta in the last line equal to 2 square root 3 pi gamma LP square. So I'll now go to the next slide. So there are two ways in which one can take one can complete this procedure. One is what I call the old approach. Most of the literature in loop quantum cosmology is based on this old approach of minimizing the area of the loop. So the idea is that we look at the area operator associated with the phase of the elementary cell, and this area operator is given is equal to mod p, and it is then also easy to see that the holonomies are the eigenstates of this p operator. And the area of the action of the area operator on these holonomies gives us this equation, which is in the second line, 8 pi gamma LP squared by 6, mu bar HK. So this is our eigenvalue, and we put this eigenvalue equal to the area gap. And this tells us that mu bar should be a constant, which I call as mu naught. So as I said, most of the work in loop quantum cosmology, if you see an archive, is based on this quantization. So the phenomenology and the singularity resolution has been extensively studied. I'll later on comment on it, a deficiency of this approach, which can be regulated in the new approach. So the new approach is that we look at the physical area, which is enclosed by the square loop. And the physical area enclosed by the square loop of kinematical length mu bar is mu bar square mod p. And if you construct an area operator and find action on the states mu, then it gives the eigenvalues 8 pi gamma LP squared by 6 mod mu bar square and the ket mu. And then we put this eigenvalue equal to the area gap, and that tells us that mu bar is no longer a constant, but it actually becomes a function of mu. So mu bar is the square root 3 root 3 divided by 2 mod mu. So mu bar doesn't become, is not a constant now, and this essentially raises a problem for us, because now we have to understand how the, what is the action of the operator e to the power I mu bar c by 2 to understand what is our quantum constraint. So to understand the action of the operator e to the power I mu bar c by 2, where mu bar is a function of mu, let us first go and look at what was the action of e to the power I mu naught c by 2, where mu naught was a constant. So if we have this operator, which is in the last equation of this slide, acting on some state psi of mu, then the action of this operator is to redrag the state psi tilde by a unit affine parameter distance along the vector field mu naught d by d mu. So this is what this operator does. It just redrags the state. So what we do is we set the action of e to the power mu bar c by 2. I'm on the next transparency now. Transparency 11. So now what we do is we set the action of e to the power I mu bar c by 2 on psi tilde mu as a lead drag by a unit affine parameter distance along the vector field mu bar d by d mu. So that's what is the idea here. And then we can find out the affine parameter of this vector field, which is given by v, small v, equal to some constant k, equal to sine of mu and mod mu to the power 3 by 2, where k is this constant, 2 square root divided by 3 square root 3 square root 3. It turns out that, so if you recall, I showed you the expression of the volume function on the phase space, which was equal to mod p to the power 3 by 2, and mu is the eigenvalue of the p operator, so v is essentially proportional to the eigenvalues of the volume operator. Also, the function v mu is invertible, so the map between v and mu is 1 to 1, and it is a C1 function of mu. So we can then ask what is the action of V. So the idea is that once we know this affine parameter V, it turns out that it's much more easier to work with the V basis now. So we shift to the V basis from the mu basis at this stage, and we can ask what is the action of V on the ket V, small v. And the action is given on the right-hand side, 8 pi gamma by 6 to the power 3 by 2 mod V by K LP cube of V. And these kets form an orthonormal basis in H kinematical, which is V1, the product of V1 ket V2 equal to delta V1 comma V2. And in this V basis, if we consider the states psi of V, then the action of the operator e to the power I mu bar C by 2 on psi of V is very simple. It's just psi of V plus 1. So it just lead drags the state by the unit affine parameter as we wanted. So one could have not shifted to the V basis, but the action then becomes very complicated. So that is why they shift to the V basis in this case. Now I'll go to the next slide. Once we have understood the action of this operator e to the power I mu bar C by 2, then we can look at what is the constraint. And the action C of the C graph operator on psi of V is given as the following: F plus V psi of V plus 4 plus F0 V psi of V plus F minus V psi of V minus 4. So it couples psi in steps of 4. And this is what results from the gravitational part. And this is equal to the C matter psi of V. So this F plus, F minus, and F0 are some functions of V. And I have given an expression for F plus of V, which you can see. It's 27 by 16 times some constant, mod V plus 2, and then a mod, and the difference between the mods V plus 1 and V plus 3. Similarly, F minus V and F0 V can be expressed in terms of F plus V. So the properties of this gravitational operator are that it is self-adjoint and is negative definite. And this is, as you can see, it is a difference equation, different from what we get in the Wheeler-DeWitt quantization, where we have the differential equation. The evolution occurs in the steps, which are constants in eigenvalues of the volume operator. So earlier constraint, which you have seen in the literature, which was based on mu naught evolution, had steps which are constant 4 mu 0 in the eigenvalues of the triad operator. So this is, if you want to see as the evolution in volume, then the evolution in volume occurs in the constant steps of 4 unit volume. If you think in terms of evolution in V, then given any state, evolution is non-singular across V equal to 0. So even when you hit the V equal to 0. Also, if you look at very large volumes, that is mod V much greater than 1, then one can show that the C gravitational goes to C gravitational corresponding to the Wheeler-DeWitt with the natural factor ordering. Later on, I'll come back to this point. Now I'll go to the next slide. So far we have seen that we got a difference equation, and if we think in terms of V evolution, one can starting from any state, one can go across V equal to 0. But there are many questions which remain unanswered, and they are more pertaining to the physics of the resolution of singularity. So the question is, what is the physics of singularity resolution? What actually happens? What questions are we answering? Are we answering any question which we posed in the beginning of the talk? And what are the physical predictions in loop quantum cosmology? These questions have been difficult to answer so far, because we didn't have a notion of an inner product, we didn't know what is a physical Hilbert space, we didn't know what are the Dirac observables, how to construct semi-classical states, and how to answer these questions. And this is where the answer is hidden, and this is what I call algorithm to extract physics in loop quantum cosmology. So the first step is that take a model and seek a dynamical variable that can play the role of internal time. Now this is not a necessary requirement. You can do without it, but it will be much easier if you have it, because then you have a clear notion of what is evolution, what is dynamics, and you can clearly interpret the physics. The next step is to introduce an inner product and to find out a physical Hilbert space. Then, in the classical theory, you should have some Dirac observable, so you should construct it, and you should raise them to quantum operators. And then, using these Dirac observables, we should construct physical semi-classical states. Now you have a choice. What the choice we took was to construct physical semi-classical states representing a large classical universe. Why we do so is because then we don't have any prejudice of what is going on near the Big Bang. What we know for sure is what is going on today, that we live in a large classical expanding universe, and it's natural to construct the initial state which represents our universe, and then evolve this state backwards using the quantum constraint. And then classical equations told you that you will hit the Big Bang, and other models which were trying to explain very early universe also told you that we don't know what's going to happen because we don't know what is non-perturbative quantum gravity. But since we claim that we have a non-perturbative quantum gravity, or at least a quantum cosmological model based on it, then should we evolve this state backwards towards the Big Bang and see what is actually going on. And then we analyze the behavior of the expectation values and the fluctuations of these Dirac observables. And based on this analysis, one can compare the trajectories which one obtains from quantum dynamics with the classical dynamics, and then one can just extract predictions from this comparison. So that is what is now I'm going to explain for a very simple model. Now let's go to the next slide. Hello, is there any question at this stage? So I'm at slide 14 here. The title is Massless Taylor Field Model. So is everyone here?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Now we consider this simple model of a massless scalar field. So this is our matter content. The classical phase space is spanned by the connection C, the triad P, the scalar field phi, and the canonical conjugate to it P phi. Phi and P phi, they satisfy this Poisson bracket, phi P phi equal 1. So the constraint C graph plus C matter is this expression minus 6. So there are no hacks on the left-hand side. That's like, it's just a classical constraint at this stage. So minus 6 C squared by gamma squared, square root of mod P plus 8 pi G P phi squared by mod P to the power 3 by 2. So classically, one can solve the Hamilton's equations and one can find that P phi is constant of motion and phi goes as log of mu or log of V. So if you plot the classical trajectories, which are plotted in this figure, on the y-axis there is phi, and on the x-axis there is V. So if you imagine that our universe was just filled of massless scalar field and there was no matter content, then we are living somewhere on the upper branch, somewhere at very large V. And if you look at the backward evolution of this branch just goes to V equal to zero, and this is what is a Big Bang. So the expanding branch evolved backwards, just hits the Big Bang. Similarly, one has the contracting branch, which is the lower branch, and this branch corresponds to a contracting universe, which evolved forward, that is towards V equal to zero, Big Crunch. The important thing is that in this model, all solutions are singular. You don't have any exotic potential or any exotic property of the field which can mask the singularity in some special case. So take any solution, take any P phi, and you always hit a singularity. To understand what actually goes on, quantum gravity effects. So now let us go to the next slide. Since phi is a monotonic function in this model, it can easily play the role of internal time. So this is what was the dynamical variable which we wanted, and this will act as our evolution parameter. So it refers here now to a relational dynamics. It will be the way in which the geometry or V changes with phi or changes with time. So phi, it's a good clock. It can play the role of time. Look at the way the geometry changes with this time or the phi. Now we can construct Dirac observables. So the set of Dirac observables we can choose is P phi, which was a canonical conjugate momentum to phi. It's a constant classically. So this is what is our matter degree, essentially. And the next Dirac observable, what we choose is the geometry at given instant phi equal to phi naught. or mod V at phi naught.
That's scary. That's Bombay.
Sorry, it's not clear.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear any of that, so could you repeat it, please?
Hello?
Yeah, I think we couldn't hear the question, so if you could repeat it.
Shall we continue?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. So we have the Dirac observables, and we also found our dynamical variable, which can act as time. Now the remaining thing is what happens to C matter. So in this case, if you remember, the C matter is P phi squared by P to the power 3 by 2, so it contains inverse powers of the triad. And again, as in the gravitational part, we have to use Thiemann's trick to find the expression of it in terms of the Poisson bracket between the holonomies and the positive powers of triad. I have not shown that expression here, but it's similar to what I showed you earlier. And then we can quantize it, and we can get the expression which is in front of you. The operator sine of p, pi square root of mod p acting on state v, is this expression, 6 pi 8 pi gamma lp squared to the power half, v to the power 1 by 3, where v is a function of v, which is given below. The property of this is that for large v, the eigenvalue of this operator approaches sine p divided by square root of p, so it has a nice classical limit. And then using this, we can find out the action of the geometric density operator, which was sitting in the matter part, hat mod p to the power minus 3 by 2, action of on psi of v is given by this expression. 6 by 8 pi gamma lp squared to the power 3 by 2, and the function b of b. So now we have all the ingredients, and we can look at what is the gravitational constraint. So let's go to the next slide, page 16. So we had the equation c grav psi equal to the expression in terms of f plus, f zero, and f minus, equal to C matter of psi. So what I have done here is just some rearrangement. So P phi square leads to this del phi square on the left hand side. And then I have taken the function B of V in the left hand side, which arises from the operator 1 over mod P to the power 3 by 2 to the right hand side. And then I have re-expressed F plus, F0 and F minus in new form, C plus, C minus and C zero. And this is equal to what I define as theta operator. There is a typo in this equation. The extreme right-hand side should have a minus sign. That's actually minus theta. It should not be theta. So the C plus and C minus and C zero have a form similar to what I showed you earlier for F plus, F minus, and F zero. And now the state, again, has a property that it is it couples the points with a difference of 4 in unit V, and it also depends on phi. So if you look at this equation, del phi square psi equal to minus theta of psi, then this constraint is similar to the massless Klein-Gordon equation in the static space-time, where the phi again plays the role of time and theta plays the role of Laplacian type operator. And the property of theta is that it's self-adjoint and it's positive definite, because C graph earlier was negative definite and we have a minus sign in this equation. So now let's go to the next slide. So other properties of this operator are that if you look at large volumes, for V much, much greater than 1, then the function b of v approaches its Willer-Debit limit, which is b of v equal to some constant by 1 over v. And one can obtain the Willer-Debit limit for the gravitational constraint, which is given in the form of the equation in on this page. Del phi square action of on psi is 12 pi g v d by dv v d by dv psi. And this is a natural factor ordering which appears in the Willer-Debit theory. So if you recall, in geometric dynamics, for the gravity part, the classical constraint is GAB, PAPB, where GAB is the DeWitt metric. And in the quantum theory, the natural choice of factor ordering is to have a Laplacian for the GAB. And this equation essentially tells us that this is what we have. This is what is we are getting naturally when we take the limit of the equation del phi square psi equal to minus theta psi. Hello? Is there any question here?
Maybe somebody. It looks like if I'm
hello, this is Rupert speaking, and we can't hear any of the questions and possible the answers. Is that our problem, or is that the problem of the questioner?
Big problem from the person who is asking questions. Can you hear me, Hanno?
Yeah, I can hear you fine, Param. Thanks.
So I'll just continue. I cannot hear the questions from this particular group, and that's why I'm not answering so far.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. So this is what is the limit of the constraint. I'm slightly short of time here, so I'll just go through it more quickly. So the states which are in the on the space of solutions also have the property that the action of the parity operator pi on psi of hello. I think I'll just go on. If you have any questions, please ask them after the talk. Okay. So
I think you should go ahead. I think it's someone's speakerphone is picking up just background noise. It's not a question.
Okay. Thank you. So pi, the parity operator here, represents a large case transformation on the space of solutions, and we do not have any observables in the model which can detect the change in orientation of the trial. So the physical considerations tell us that we should look for the symmetric states in the theory, which are invariant under this pi operation. So now I'll go to the next slide. So once we have this structure, then we can define an inner product, and it can be defined in two ways. The first is a heuristic way. That is to demand action of the operators corresponding to Dirac observables is self-adjoint. And the next, the more technical way is group averaging. Both of them lead to the same result. And I'll just state the result now. Essentially, the states psi can be decomposed into positive and negative frequency subspaces. The evolution and action of the Dirac observables leave these subspaces invariant. So we look for the positive frequency solutions, which satisfy minus I d phi psi equal to square root theta psi. Hello? And the inner product is given in the next line. Bra psi 1 ket psi 2 is the summation over V, B of V, psi 1 conjugate, psi 2 conjugate. So if we see this inner product is independent of time and will be preserved during the evolution, then we can also find out the action of the Dirac observables, which act as the Dirac observable corresponding to the momentum acts as P phi, hat acting on psi is minus I h bar d phi psi, and corresponding to geometry, v at phi naught, when it acts on psi of v at phi, it
translate the state to from psi of v of phi naught to psi of v of phi. So theta operator, what we have, since the equation what we have is a difference equation, what we achieve, what we get is that the physical Hilbert space is divided into various sectors, which are epsilon sectors, where epsilon goes from 0 to 2, and the states have support on V equal to mod epsilon plus 4n, where n is some integer. So you can pick up any sector which you wish. The results, what we have, are insensitive to the choice of sectors. So let us go to the next slide. Now I'll come to the numerics part, because we have explained how one can seek a dynamical variable, how one can construct, how one can find an inner product to construct physical Hilbert space, and what are the properties of that Hilbert space. What? So what I'll explain in the numerics is what we call as evolution in phi, or it's essentially evolution in time. It's an initial value problem posed in phi, and we look for the solution of the equation del phi square psi equal to minus theta psi. Since theta is a discrete operator, this equation results in a countable number of coupled ordinary differential equations. What we then do is to specify the initial data at some instant of time, phi equal to phi naught, and this specification consists of specifying psi v at phi naught and its velocity, del of phi psi at phi naught. The initial data can be specified in three different ways. I'll not go into the details of that. And in the specification, essentially, we also use classical equations, or sometimes the Willebrand theory. But this was only for the specification of the initial data. The state is always evolved using the quantum constraint. So for having the semi-classical states, we choose a very large value of P5 star, and then we fix a point V star phi naught, that is a space and time on the classical trajectory for very large V, so V star much greater than 1, which corresponds to a large classical universe. So we are in a very large classical universe, we are choosing a state with the value P5 equal to P5 star and the point V equal to V star. And this is what will be our semi-classical state. So we choose a semi-classical state at very late times, peaked at some value of P5. An example of this state is... So the example of this initial state is what I have shown in the last equation, the psi at V at instant phi naught, as an integral over dk psi prime k. So psi prime k was chosen as a Gaussian, and ek of v, which were the eigenfunctions of the Willebrand, saying this power I omega phi naught minus phi star, where omega is related to the eigenvalues of the theta operator. So once we have chosen an initial state like this, then we evolve that constraint backward using the quantum constraint. So that's what we do. So let's come to the next slide.
Well, now I'm not applying the psi of this.
Yeah.
So when I apply the psi here.
Hello?
I think just go ahead. I think it's background noise.
Okay, thank you. So now I'm on slide number 20, which there is a figure, quantum bounds, and it's a 3D plot. On one axis, there is phi, on the other axis, there is v, and on the vertical axis, there is magnitude of the absolute value of psi, of v phi. And what essentially, this is an example of one of the numerical simulations in which we start from phi equal to 0 at around v, which is shown here as 40,000, and the state is sharply peaked at some value of p phi and v. And this state is evolved backwards using the quantum constraint what we had towards the Big Bang. So this branch, which the left-hand side branch in the figure, is actually corresponding to the expanding branch of the universe. The state is sharply peaked as a large classical universe, and the state evolved backwards towards the Big Bang. And as you can see, the state evolved backwards, and when it reaches small v, or the large energy densities, later on I'll show you the more details, the state bounces at a finite non-zero value of V to another branch, which turns out to be the contracting branch of the universe with the same value of P phi.
So this is an example where the state is evolved backwards, it bounces at Planck scale, and then it just latches on to the contracting branch.
One could have repeated this experiment with the Wheeler-DeWitt theory, and one will choose a state with the same initial data, and if it evolves, one evolves it backwards, it will not bounce, actually it will go into the Big Bang at V equals zero. So that is a difference that you can compare with the Wheeler-DeWitt theory. So now let us go to the next slide. And I will now summarize the results of the numerics of loop quantum evolution. So the results are that the states remain sharply peaked throughout evolution. Exponential values of the observables V of phi and P phi remain in good agreement with the classical trajectories until the energy density of the field becomes of the order of a critical density, which is of the order of Planck. When the critical density is reached, the state bounces from the expanding branch to the contracting branch, the same value of this phenomena is generic. It doesn't depend on the choice of sector or the choice of P phi. And essentially the idea is that the Big Bang, what we had, is replaced by a big bounce at the Planck scale. Further, the norm remains preserved and the expectation value of P phi remains constant throughout the evolution. Fluctuations of observables of the Dirac observables remain small. Depending on how you specify the initial state, some differences arise near the bounce point, but they are very near to the bounce point. Now let's go to the next slide. In the next slide, I have compared the evolution or the classical trajectory of the comparison of the classical trajectory of phi of v with what we obtained from the numerical evolution. So these are green dotted line is the classical trajectory, and the red points with dashes are the values of V of phi. So the upper branch corresponds to the expanding branch, the lower branch corresponds to the contracting branch. So we started the state from the expanding branch, we evolved it backwards, and as you can see, the red line is in very good agreement with the green line till we reach the Planck scale, somewhere V of the order of 3000 here. And then it doesn't follow the green line all through to the Big Bang, but it jumps from the green line to the green line which was corresponding to the contracting branch. Now in the Wheeler-DeWitt theory or in any other theory, this transition from the expanding branch to the contracting branch could not be achieved. So here we see that the classical dynamics is in good agreement till scales of the order of B equal to 10,000, and then the deviation in the dynamics start, and the state jumps from the state follows some other trajectory, which is given by an effective Friedman equation. I'll tell you the details of that, and then it just latches on to the contracting branch. So one achieves a big bounce instead of a big bang. So big bang doesn't occur. Now let's go to the next slide. So using the geometric methods of quantum mechanics, one can also find out what is an effective equation which can describe this bounce. And this effective Friedman equation turns out to be what I've shown in this slide, h square equal to kappa by 3 rho, 1 minus rho by rho critical, where rho critical is this constant on the right-hand side. It is approximately 0.8 times the Planck density. And the features of this equation are, if you recall, I have shown you the equation for the Brainwell scenarios in the beginning of the talk. That had rho 1 plus rho by 2 sigma. So the bounce was impossible in those scenarios. But here, this equation tells us that when the energy density is much, much smaller than rho critical, then this equation essentially reduces to the classical Friedman equation, h square equal to kappa by 3 rho. But when we reach a critical energy density, then this parenthesis becomes zero and h square becomes zero. So there is a bounce because a dot becomes zero. The scale factor just bounces. So this is a very small difference, as you see in the equation, but it leads to profound implications for the physics. So now let us go to the next slide. So I will just start summarizing now my talk. So let us go back to the questions and see what we have achieved so far. So first question was, does the theory provide a non-singular evolution through the Big Bang?
So the answer what we find is that in this model, that is true for all solutions, but even the notion of Big Bang has changed. Big Bang is not what we used to think classically. It's linked to what is on the other side of the Big Bang. So what was on the other side of the Big Bang? That was the question. Is it a quantum form or a classical space-time? So the answer is that if you evolve our expanding universe backwards, then the universe escapes the Big Bang and bounces at Planck scale to a pre-Big Bang classical contracting branch. So we asked, what is the scale at which the space-time ceases to be classical, and does the space-time continuum exist at all scales? The answer is that when the energy density becomes of the order of a critical energy density, which is 0.82 times rho Planck, deviations from classical dynamics start becoming significant, and this is the point where one can say that the classical space-time picture is not valid. They are, the modifications of quantum gravity to the classical dynamics have become important. And this is where the space-time ceases to be classical. And in the deep Planck regime, the space-time, the effective picture itself breaks down, and so there is no continuum space-time, and that is what is the answer here. The next question was, what about the modifications to the Friedman equation? So as I have shown you, the modifications are rho-scale modifications to the Friedman equation at high energies, but they come with a negative sign, which is different from the models and the theory. So now let us come to the next slide. So this is slide number 25, summary and open issues. So I will now summarize the results. So loop quantum cosmology provides a new picture of the universe near and at the Big Bang and beyond the Big Bang. There is no Big Bang. Big Bang is not the beginning, and Big Crunch not the end. So what this model tells us is that the two classical regions of space-time are joined by a quantum geometric bridge at the Planck scale. The quantum gravitational effects become very important at the Planck scale, and they yield a non-singular evolution for the generic initial data. So in this model, we had a massless scalar field, so our equation of state was W equal to 1, so it was not exotic matter. So we haven't introduced any exotic matter, we haven't introduced any ad hoc assumptions, that two extra time-like dimensions achieve this bounce. Essentially, the long-standing problem of singularity resolution in homogeneous and isotropic space-time seems resolved, and we have opened new avenues to test the non-perturbative quantum gravity technique. Also, I should add that important lessons have been learned in the quantization of simple models about ambiguity. So an example of that is that one could have taken the old approach of minimizing the area of the loop. That gives us the mu naught evolution. It turns out that it gives us a bounce, and the evolution is also non-singular. However, the critical density at which the bounce occurs is not a constant. It's proportional to 1 over the scalar field momentum, p phi. So if you choose a very large value of p phi, you can make critical density as small as you want. So the bounce could occur at any small curvature, even the energy density of water. So this is something very, very unnatural. And this could not have been seen unless we would have studied the physical ramifications of this particular choice in full detail. So as we see here, this is a lesson which we learned that though we may have choices of ambiguities, of quantization ambiguities in the theory, if we extract physics and if we study the phenomenology of what goes on, then we can narrow down these choices. And this is what led us to the choice of V evolution, which doesn't have this problem, in which the bounce occurs at Planck scale. So now I'm going to the last slide of my talk. Next slide. So I again state that the results what I've reported here are obtained in a flat, homogeneous, and isotropic model, and it is devoid of perturbation. So it is not a realistic cosmos that we see around us. It's completely homogeneous and isotropic. There are not even small perturbations. I think the biggest question for this particular model is, does the picture of the bounce survive if we add the perturbation? So a lot of work has been started in this direction. So the first idea is that we should relax the symmetries, and the work is in progress. And early indications from the spherically symmetric models indicate that the singularity can be resolved, but a detailed model has yet to be studied, and we don't know what is the physics of the singularity resolution in such models. You can also ask what happens in slightly more general situations. For example, what happens in the case of closed models? What happens if you include anisotropies and potentials? All these questions can be answered, at the current stage, and at least for the closed model, we already know the answer, that a similar picture appears. If you start with a large expanding universe, the universe will escape the Big Bang singularity in the past and enter the contracting branch. In fact, the closed model can also give us a cyclic model, because at the large scale, due to curvature effects, the universe can again start to recollapse. So, also the issues of anisotropies and the incorporation of potentials have been started to be looked up, and here the effect theory already gives us some indications of what goes on near the singularity resolution. But I think one of the very important questions, which is now going to become very prominent, is what is the connection of this model with the full theory? And that will be important to understand if you also want to completely understand how the perturbations can be incorporated in this model. I think the hope is that if once we incorporate the perturbations in this model, then we can understand this question also in much more detail, that what is, how does this theory may descend from loop quantum gravity. Perhaps the most important question still remains is, what is a testable prediction? So what we just have shown is that in this particular model, there is a bounce, there is a large contracting universe on the other side, but it's still not the complete realistic universe. So I cannot make any testable prediction here, which you can go on and test in cosmic microwave background or somewhere else. That's the big question of whether the model conforms to the observations remains at the moment open. So I think on this note of that, a lot of future work is to be done in this direction. I'll stop. And please ask questions. Thanks.
So I have a question.
Hello? Yeah?
So one of the long-standing issues for these kind of models that tunnel through a singularity is what would happen to perturbations as they tunnel through a singularity. And as you said, I mean, because your study is homogeneous, you really can't answer this in detail. But I was wondering if one could learn any sort of hints from your figure, I think it's transparency 20, the 3D picture, because everyone has a quantum state that has a width. And as it sort of tunnels through the singularity, it seems to come out on the other side with the same width. So it sort of suggests that nothing dramatic happens to deviations from the state, so to speak, although everything is still homogeneous. Is that an analogy one can sort of push and say that, well, perturbations will sort of behave in the same way and come out the same way they entered the singularity?
Yeah, probably as the first intuition on this, it's correct. But since the states remain sharply peaked, then small perturbations over this space-time may behave in a very similar manner. But I think one has to still check it, because it may happen that with perturbations, even the difference equation may not retain the same form. So we may not be... So this expectation at the level of an effective equation or an effective theory seems okay, but I think unless we check how do we incorporate perturbation in the quantum theory and how does the quantum constraint change, I think it's very difficult to fully justify. That's what I'll say at this stage.
Thanks.
This is also sort of an additional complication, really, which is that this is some work that Martin had done with some other people, Martin Boyewal, I think with Date and somebody else, that they showed that if I consider just anisotropies, right, so to forget about inhomogeneities at all, so it's still a mini superspace, but if I look at anisotropies and I can look at it, the equation exactly, quantum difference equation, then they found, they were doing it in a slightly older framework, but the same thing is true in the newer framework, they find that the singularity is actually resolved. However, if they consider anisotropies as small perturbations on isotropic background, and so you've got a background space-time, so to say, and anisotropies are just regarded as perturbations, but perturbations in the sense you ignore higher order terms, then it turned out that the singularity is not resolved. So this suggests that really to get a good answer, one would have to do some kind of really hard computer simulations with inhomogeneities, where inhomogeneities can be small, but still they will have to be treated kind of using exact quantum equation rather than just perturbation equation. And that to me is kind of, at the moment, conceptually or technically the hardest thing. But Martin and Param and and some students have started looking at the inhomogeneous equations, and I guess it's a matter of time to check what happens with the computer calculations.
So this is Hannes from Utrecht, and I would like to ask another question if there is no more discussion about a bias comment.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. So I wanted to ask about the difference between mu evolution and v evolution, and whether the new v evolution brings any new problems in terms of well-definedness of the evolution. Because, I mean, there are two questions, right? The one question is our quantum time evolution actually well-defined? And the next question is, like, does it lead to another macroscopic branch or something like this? And it seems that in the old new evolution, generically, there was no problem at the Big Bang. But so how about the evolution? Do you expect this to hold true generically?
So the answer to your question is that as in the old mu naught evolution, if you look at the same level, the V evolution, there is no problem. The resolution of the singularity is generic. If you think about evolution in terms of V, irrespective of the state you choose, you can go through the Big Bang. So there is as such no problem in the quantum evolution. So it is just that in the mu naught evolution, the physical ramifications were not correct. They were very unnatural. Whereas in the V evolution, which we have now, the physical ramifications can be much better understood because we know that the bounds occurs when we reach the Planck scales. So the difference at the level of difference equation is only that in the old evolution, the evolution occurred in the steps of 4 mu naught, and essentially it occurred by the unit scale factor square operator, and here in the new evolution it is occurring by unit volume.
Okay, thank you very much.
I know your question was more mathematical, I think. Is that right? Or?
Well, I think I was also thinking about like more complicated models, whether you would expect anything new to happen there, but I guess you guys have to check that, right?
Sorry, so the statement is that in the homogeneous and isotropic model, the mathematics is completely under control in the sense that with the new evolution, it is exactly again, this theta operator is again self-adjoint positive definite operator, and where in fact the spectral decomposition and everything is completely under control, and therefore there is no problem with the evolution being well-defined. And completely generically, if you start out with a semi-classical state in distant future, you get a semi-classical state in the distant past. If you ask what happens with more general models, that is to say even anisotropic models or inhomogeneous models, that is something that is being still looked at, constructing this mu bar evolution in the anisotropic models. There's a version that is available, but I'm not sure it is a final version.
Okay, thank you very much, Papai. That helped.
Any other questions? Well, if you have no more questions, then maybe we should thank Pramp again and finish the call. Thank you.
Okay, just a second. I have an announcement, a quick announcement. Because the information about the quantum gravity in the Americas conference, which is going to take place towards the end of August, this appeared both in the topical gravity group of APS and the McCallum list. Because of that, all kinds of people are making hotel reservations, not necessarily kind of the key people in quantum loop quantum gravity. So I'm just concerned that the hotels might get filled up. So I would urge all of you to really make your reservations early. I think Jorge has already made one, but others, I urge you to make the reservations early.
Okay, thanks everyone.
Okay, bye-bye, and Jorge will send out a note about the next seminar.
Yes, goodbye.